It's worked so far, but we're not out yet.
I wanna know what you're thinking. There are some things you can't hide. I wanna know what you're feeling. Tell me what's on your mind.
Pure energy. 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 Pure energy.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Next Lander Watchcast. I am your host, Alex Navarro. Joining me, as always, we have Vinny Caravella.
Hello. Hi.
Hi. Hello.
Hi. 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 Hello.
Hi. Hello.
Hi. Hello.
Hi. Hello. Brad Shoemaker, always joining us, as always.
Live long and prosper?
Yeah. I would like to do that, if at all possible. I feel like it's a good message.
I'll take either. Just prosper or live long. Just give me... Listen, I'm not a man of many needs.
I don't know if I want to live long if I'm not prospering.
That's a good point.
So that was the original... Has he said that? Yes, has Spock said that?
Know.
Not yet.
Okay.
Yeah, nor has he done the salute, right?
No, I think all that stuff is season two.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Well, don't get ahead of ourselves, please. Spoilers.
No,
spoilers.
We can't, because we're not done with Star Trek season one yet, though we are getting... achingly close to wrapping up this season. We are on episodes, I believe, 25 and 26 here. And then at the end of this month, we will be doing a triple header of the final three episodes of season one of Star Trek, the original series. And I'm looking forward to finishing the season. I feel like as we have gone through it, I have seen like a real development in terms of this show, in terms of its confidence, the things it's trying out, what's sticking, what isn't. And I feel like this episode is also pretty emblematic of them late in the season coming up with some things, trying some things, some of which are going to stick and some of which don't.
Yeah, you're talking about, wait, this episode in particular, the one we are going to start with?
The two that we're talking about.
Oh, okay.
Here.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a couple of recurring bits in here, some which continue on, some which less so, but I feel like we're seeing them just take some swings at some stuff and seeing where it lands.
As someone with a, you guys must watch this and just laugh and laugh. I like, well, errand of mercy and being like, oh my. As someone who has no idea really what the archetypes are for these characters, I'm just utterly confused. And that's errand of mercy in particular.
It's way less laughing for me and more like me like cocking my head and going, huh.
Like, so this is how it started.
Weird.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not what I was expecting.
Yeah, Errand of Mercy is one of the episodes we'll be covering, though that will be the back half of this episode, and that is our very first Klingon episode, so we'll have plenty of Klingon talk to do during that section. But first, we have another episode, and it is what I'm going to call one of the best episodes, I think, of this season so far.
Interesting, okay.
And The Devil in the Dark.
I would agree with that. It's got a good core philosophical, moral kind of theme to it.
Yes.
There's some good space science in there.
Some good jumpsuits, a really wild monster costume.
That fucking pizza monster, man, not to get ahead of ourselves, but...
Some misunderstood aliens.
Mm-hmm.
That thing.
Anyway. Basically having to plug your Vulcan in to solve the problem.
Uh-huh. The hubris of man.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Spock being robotic and computer-like.
Yes, but also Spock putting on a little acting clinic, Leonard Nimoy getting out there.
Gets to stretch his legs a little bit here.
Uh-huh.
Yes, this is The Devil in the Dark, episode 25. And this is an episode, as we have kind of alluded to here, about a monstrous, murderous alien that maybe has motives that the humans on the planet don't fully understand going in.
Is this episode famous? Would you say it's like one of the, not notorious, but one of the like well-known, I've just heard the name Devil in the Dark a bunch over the years, right up there with like City on the Edge of Forever and trying to think of some other...
Well, like, you know, like Amok Time and, you know, Trouble Tribbles and that kind
of
stuff.
It's like one of the half dozen... original series episodes that I knew the names of without knowing what they were about.
Yeah, this is a really well-regarded episode. I don't know if it's one of the most popular, but it is definitely one that, like, a lot of people cite as some of their favorite from this series. Including William Shatner, who straight up says this is his favorite. He has gone on to say later on that City on the Edge of Forever was his favorite, but earlier on he said this was his favorite episode.
Huh, all right.
Okay.
And part of the reason for that was that this sounds a little weird setting it up. His father passed away while he was doing the production on this episode. And they asked him, they're like, hey, do you want to go? And he's like, no, I'm going to finish shooting. Because they were kind of near the end of shooting, I think. And so he finished it out, and apparently everyone on the crew and cast kind of rallied around him and supported him while he was finishing out his work. And I think his experience with that made him feel a lot closer to everyone on the show, which we know that some static eventually develops there, but at the time, he had a very nice time making this episode despite the tragedy.
Man, like, we've been watching so much Star Trek, and I also kind of started rewatching Boston Legal a little bit off and on over the holiday, and it just continually bums me out that Shatner is not a cooler dude.
Yeah, he's a real dingbat.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, I think the thing you can give him credit for is that he did, in fact, craft one of the most memorable characters in sci-fi in Captain Kirk over the course of these seasons and the movies and whatnot.
Yeah. It's a real separating, like, the work from the artist type thing.
Yeah, definitely. But Devil in the Dark, this, as I said, this is a Monster of the Week episode kind of thing, where the Enterprise is called to a mining planet, where they are mining an element called Pergium?
Yeah.
Yes.
Fictional element, but it is, you know, one of those kind of rare earth minerals that are very, very useful to the Federation, we shall say. And they have a real problem on this planet because, like, 50 of their damn miners have died, and by died, I mean they have melted into dust and pieces of bone.
Goo.
And so it is up to the Enterprise to, A, figure out what the hell's going on here, and B, try and stop this monster from killing everyone.
Also, turns out this place is providing pergium for, like, I don't know, the Federation. Everybody needs this pergium for their pergium reaction. The spice must flow, Alex.
We'll get into it. There's some weird stuff around the industrial aspect of this episode that I found to be a pretty stark contrast to later Star Trek.
Well, in that they use the word profitable couple of times in this episode.
Let's just get into the setup
here, because that is actually a key point of the setup, is that this is establishing the show's more, like, frontier mentality versus, like, the kind of, you know, greater collective mentality that sort of pervaded a lot of later Star Trek. Like, here it is, like, these guys on this planet, and they are profiting by bringing minerals, and, you know, they said that also, like, uranium and a bunch
gold
of other stuff is on this
planet. Diamonds!
Yeah, like, silicon, weirdly enough. But, like, they are profiting by basically delivering huge volumes of these minerals to the Federation.
And Kirk entices the head of the administrator into doing what he wants by saying, like, hey, this will be super profitable for you if you just let us do this type stuff. And there's, like, some crazy urgency on the part of the administrator to keep going, to keep producing.
And Kirk a bit.
They do kind of justify that later when they mention that the pergium is, like, I think it's critical for, like, life support or power or, like, basic needs for different colonies nearby or something. So, like, there is some survival component to it, but, like, it's very much a, we have to keep producing here, almost safety be damned. Like, it's bad that these people are dying, but we've got to keep the pergium flowing. Like, it's a weird capitalist industrial kind of vibe to the way that they are doing things here that you super do not see in later Star Trek, where everything is, like, extremely socialist.
And they've just given up on money, really.
Right. By the time Next Generation is, like, super, super, like, that society is straight up post-money, post-scarcity.
Well, I think as we get into the episode, we'll talk about it more, but there is a thrust here for Kirk that is, science expedition be damned, we need to mine, right? Like,
this stuff is necessary.
Whereas Spock is a little like, hey, man, there's an academic part to this that we need to consider. And Kirk is resistant, you know, at least at first, because he's like, whatever, you know, Kirk is usually on the side of save the lives and my crew and these people, but he's got a little bit of like, we got to get this thing up and running.
It kind of felt like one of those cases where they were writing him to serve the plot rather than to, you know, accurately represent the character as has been previously established. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, I feel like they have, well, we're getting ahead of ourselves. I feel like the administrator could have served that role of fuck this creature. It has to die so we can keep mining well enough without Kirk going so hard in that direction. But
I feel like the thing that I've picked up on from this season in particular is that at least I don't remember if it's this way always going forward, but I feel like Kirk is the character that has to learn a lesson when there is one to be learned in an episode.
Yeah.
Like, to a lesser extent, you know, Spock has a couple of times, especially that one where he had to take command. But really, like, Kirk is the character who's supposed to be the one who comes to an understanding at a certain point. Like, if there is a moral being delivered in the end of an episode, Kirk is the one that has to come to it. And obviously, there are other times where Kirk is the one mandating the moral to other people. But when there is an opportunity for a character, like, he is kind of the audience and also the Gene Roddenberry stand-in here.
I agree with you for the most part from what we've seen. I would say that's absolutely true when it isn't, when it goes outside of the basic human id, when it is pure human chutzpah or whatever, you know, like pure human drive, then Kirk is usually teaching the lesson, right?
Right.
When he makes computers blow up because it's like, you don't understand what it's like to be a human and have passion, then he's the one who's on the soapbox. But when it goes outside of, like, maybe there's more than just a drive for, you know, winning, then he's the one who has to be like, maybe you're right, Spock, you know?
And I think also part of it is that just other than him and Spock, and to a slightly lesser degree, McCoy, none of the other cast have really been established enough at this point to hang an entire episode on.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that will change as time goes on.
Maybe Sulu. I could kind of almost see a Sulu episode at this point, but...
But they haven't tried it yet, and I don't think they haven't this season.
They haven't tried it. I just mean, like, he might be fully fleshed out enough to do one.
And we got hints of it with Scotty in the last, when he was talking to that diplomat.
Sure.
All right, well, let's get into a little bit of the history here. This is relatively short. I don't have a whole lot to say about the making of this episode, but there is kind of a fun story about how it came to be. There are some conflicts here about the nature, like the exact order of events here that took place. But the one on Memory Alpha says that the reason this episode came into existence is because stuntman Janos Prochazka, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, who had worked on the series, designed the costume. At some point, someone had told him, it was like, if you come up with a good costume, maybe we'll find a way to include it in an episode. So the story on Memory Alpha says that he walked into Gene L. Coon's office one day wearing the costume that he had made, and Gene L. Coon was like, that's great. What is it? To which Prochazka replied, I don't know. It could be whatever you want. At which point Coon said he'd write a script around it.
Okay.
I had a good time once that thing was getting extended appearances on screen of trying to envision how a human being was contorting themselves in there.
Yeah.
And, like, what they were doing to shuffle back and forth across the floor.
I'm imagining, like, straps to the arms and legs where it's kind of like the front and back, and they're just kind of shaking parts of it around while scurrying on the floor. We should talk about this creature design a little bit. I don't know how to describe this thing except to say it looks like a hairy rock with a bunch of day-old challah bread fucking glued to it.
Yeah,
sure.
I don't know why I thought Pizza Monster when I first saw it.
Yeah, it has that coloring of pizza.
Like Pizza the Hut-ish?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a very weird creature.
It is. I will say, I'll give him credit. Well, are we going to go through an order? Because it's a little bit of a reveal what the nature of the creature is.
We'll get to the actual, like, reveal stuff here in a second, okay. But I wanted to tell that story because the version on Wikipedia makes it sound more like this episode was already in production and they told this stunt guy, if you come up with a costume that works, we'll use it.
I'm looking at a picture of it again. It looks like a piece of Sloppy Joe fell out.
Yes.
And, like, had cheese on it. And it, like, oh, you found this under your stove, like, maybe 2 weeks later, and it's got cheddar cheese Sloppy Joe. And it just fell out of the bun.
Yeah.
It's like chopped meat with cheese.
It's very weird looking. Janos ends up portraying the creature in the course of the episode. Our other cast members here, there's really only one of note here, which is Ken Lynch as Vandenberg, the guy who runs the mine. I don't recognize this guy from anything, but as soon as I heard his voice, I felt like I knew him from something, but I could never quite place what it was. He might just be one of those guys that, like, voiced a lot of cartoons or other things from this era, but, like, it's just a really distinctive deep timbre to him. And he was mostly a film and television actor, started out as a radio actor, which would make some sense there. The most interesting story I could find about him is that despite still working in the 1970s, He took on a second career as a flower shop owner in North Hollywood because he wasn't convinced that he was going to be able to keep working past a certain point. And so he studied horticulture and took some courses in floral arrangement and design and started providing flowers for weddings in Hollywood.
Horticulture.
The only other cast member I will mention here is Biff Elliott, not because he has done anything, but because this is a man named Biff in the wild. This is a real guy named Biff.
Biff is right up there with Bing.
Yes.
As mid-century square-jawed, like probably military veteran type names that nobody past 1950 ever named their child.
Yes, if you meet a Biff in the real world nowadays, that is almost assuredly a nickname and not their good Christian name.
Who is Biff?
Biff is just like one of the... I think he's the minor that like gets the most lines.
He's not Ed Apple or Appel.
He's not the guy in the purple. He's the other older guy, I think.
Okay.
But yeah, that's really it. I mean, there wasn't too much else on the cast here of note. The only other thing I'll say about this episode is it's apparently the only one in the series that features no women speaking roles whatsoever. And it was notable specifically to Roddenberry, who, when doing their post review of this episode, left some notes to Gene Coon being like, "Hey, the studio says we shouldn't do this, and I think they're right. We should make sure there are always speaking parts for women going forward."
Hmm.
And knowing what we know about Roddenberry, that's an interesting point for him to make.
Yeah,
yeah, I was going to say, it sounds noble, but maybe, I don't know.
It's another one of those backhanded compliment things of like, yes, you're right, it is legitimately good to do that, but also the speaking parts you're giving them are not always very robust.
Maybe there's some intent there that is worthwhile, but also not always in the execution.
It's kind of the story of the show, like progressive for its time.
Yes. So they get down to this planet, they meet up with the miners, they find out that over 50 people have died. There's a pretty good cold open to this episode with, you know, the guys sort of scattering around the mine. The one guard is like, the phaser's not enough, man, I need some help down here. And they're like, you'll be fine for 4 hours, no big deal. Yeah.
Like the rest of them, burned to a crisp.
And that guy dies horribly.
Instantly eats it.
There's a couple of at least two, maybe three of shadow looms, and then you get terrified face of
and someone just throws like a big hairy blanket over him.
Yeah.
There's like some good allusions early in this episode to how fast this thing supposedly can move.
Yeah.
Compared to how fast you see it moving later.
Yes. They're somewhat limited by the human underneath the suit, but yeah, the idea is that it is very quick and it kills incredibly quickly because this, you know, those guys came running back as soon as they heard the screams and there was just nothing left.
Some smoke,
some dust, a couple bones.
Some teeth maybe.
And so the Enterprise arrives, and yes, this is where we establish that, like, not only are these miners incredibly anxious to continue their work and not die in the process, but Kirk is very adamant that this be taken care of. They know there's something down there. There's a creature down there, but no one who has seen it has really survived, save for one, I think, and even he only caught a glimpse of it.
Yeah. Also, I think it's, like, right here at the beginning, pretty much, that just as an aside, the miners are like, oh, by the way, we've been finding like thousands of these silicon-based spheroids down there, these perfect, perfect globes of almost pure silicon.
Yeah, they're worthless, like, but we've been finding them down there. Inert.
We've been crushing them up, whatever. There's nothing else in there.
I'm pretty sure he just put one of them on his desk as a decoration.
Yeah.
Like it's just like the most obvious tell, like right there at the beginning.
And you get like a Spock. Fascinating.
Yeah.
Like you can tell he's formulating something, but he doesn't want to say it out loud.
They really stretch out that a little bit much here, but anyway.
Well, I've made my report to you. Production has stopped, and nobody will go into the lower levels, and I don't blame them. Federation wants per GM, then you're going to have to do something about it.
That's why we're here, Mr. Vandenberg.
You're all pretty tough, aren't you? Starship,
Phaser Banks. Well, you can't get your starship down to the tunnels.
I don't think there'll be any need to, Mr. Appel. Mr. Vandenberg, I'll need a complete subsurface chart of all the drifts, galleries, tunnels.
You'll get it.
Mr. Vandenberg, what is this?
It's a silicon nodule. There are a million of them down there. No commercial value.
But a geological oddity, to say the least. Pure silicon.
A few trace elements. Look, we didn't call you here so you could collect rocks.
Thank you, Mr. Vandenberg. We'll need your complete cooperation.
You'll have it. Just find that creature, whatever it is. I've got a quota to meet.
Is it Vandenberg? Is Vandenberg? Is that the
Vandenberg,
guy's name?
Yeah.
I like, there's a very, like, union vibe to the whole thing of, like, we got a guy. I got guys dying down here. We got to get the Pregium. You boys from the...
You company boys. You don't know what we're going through down here.
You Federation guys, you get down there and figure it out. We just cracked into the mother load down there. Turns out when we cracked into the mother load, people also started dying. Turns out we found these spheres. I don't know.
Can't imagine how any of this is connected. It's neither here nor there. I don't get paid to speculate. I get paid to mine, all right?
And check out my sick belt. Isn't it sick? I like this outfit.
Yes. Yeah, like Harlan County Alpha Quadrant here.
Which is different than the kind of, it's not the Frontier Wild West group. It's very much,
This is a real organization. There's like at least a couple hundred people down here.
Yeah, this is their offshore mining rig style. Like, yeah. We got to turn these machines on. You guys figure it out.
Yeah. And so, you know, I will say this is, while I don't think this is the episode credited as creating the red shirt, this is the one that absolutely emphasizes it the most, because as soon as they beam down with their security team, here is a row of guys in red shirts. Let's guess which one's gonna die.
I think, where's the part? It's way before that. It's way at the beginning, right? Where is it Spock who proposes that maybe that it's a different life form, not based on carbon, and that's the phasers?
Yes. I can't remember when that comes in exactly.
And like, is it McCoy who gives him like a, I'm a doctor. That's impossible. Stop. You've been playing too much Mass Effect. Stop it.
But why now, Mr. Spock? These production facilities have been in operation for over 50 years.
I don't know. But there is a possibility.
What's that?
Life as we know it is universally based on some combination of carbon compounds. But what if life exists based on another element? For instance, silicon.
You're creating fantasies, Mr. Spock.
Not necessarily, Bones. I've heard of the theoretical possibility of life based on silicon, but silicon-based life would be of an entirely different order. It's possible that our phasers might not affect it.
Certainly not Phaser 1, which is far less powerful than Phaser 2.
All right. How about this? A creature that lives deep in the planet below us, at home in solid rock. It seems to me that in order to survive, it would have to have some form of natural armor plating.
It could explain much, especially since the colonists are armed only with Phaser 1.
But our people have Phaser number 2.
Which I could adjust to be more effective against silicon.
Silicon-based life is physiologically impossible. Especially in an oxygen atmosphere.
It may be, Doctor, that the creature can exist for brief periods in such an atmosphere before returning to its own environment.
I still think you're imagining things.
You may be right, Doctor, but at least there's something to go on.
Yeah, but no, it is Spock who formulates the idea that maybe this life form is not carbon-based the way that all life in the universe that we know at this point is. Though, let's be real, we've already encountered some fairly energetic beings, too, that are not necessarily carbon-based. But yes, the idea that this creature is silicon-based.
Yeah,
I love that that's the thing that McCoy scoffs at after the range of beings he has already encountered.
Right.
You're going to tell me that Trelane is less of a leap to make than fucking this silicon-based life form?
Like, you've met multiple literal gods at this point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What does God need with silicon?
And you're about to meet some more, anyway.
Yes.
I can't quite remember the sequence of events. Like, Spock postulates that, that they could be dealing with a new type of life form they're not familiar with.
It might be later on, because that's, at that point, that's when, it's, or no, that's when he's like, He's like, go ahead. No, Kirk is like, explain. And he's
please
like,
elaborate. Well,
and he's like, I don't know. McCoy's already laughed at me enough. I'm going to hold this one in my pocket for a little bit.
Yeah. Well, because they spend a bunch of time running around in these tunnels, which are the most papier-mâché tunnels you've ever seen in your goddamn
nice
life.
Nice lighting, though.
I nice lighting. Was, yeah. It sets a mood, but there you can literally see the crinkles in the paper that are not the ones that are intentional. And they just kind of skulk around in the dark for a little bit. You know, the red shirts are looking for the creature. One of them does die the exact same way. It's just the blah blanket. and it's while they're skulking around, I think that Spock starts kind of laying it down of like, this might be a kind of life form we don't know anything about. And also, it could be, if it's only one, it might be the last one going around.
Yeah, I'm kind of skimming memory alpha to jog my memory here. Like, they, first of all, they realize, like, oh, maybe our phasers didn't work on it because they were not attuned to work on silicon.
Oh, I was going to ask you guys, is phaser type one a thing?
So,
yes, but I think the meaning is kind of all over the place, depending on the needs of the story.
So, in this case, this is the only episode, I think, where they refer to it this way, but there are two kinds of phasers. There's the little tiny ones, which are sort of like the, you know, cell phone-sized ones, and then there's the ones that look like the guns.
Okay.
Well, they're sort of like a melted, like... Oh, wait, oh, I'm sorry, in the original series.
In the original series, yes.
They do straight up look like pistols.
Yeah.
And it's like, so is like one stun and one kill, or it's just a different type of...
Probably just a level of power.
Okay, yeah. Okay, sorry, I didn't want to derail it. Just
No, that's fair, because I think this is the only time this specifically thing comes up.
But here they're like, you know, adjusting a wavelength or something like that to work on silicon better, and so there's that. And then Spock is all speculating about, like, oh, there are far too many tunnels down here in this complex for... Or like, they can't figure out, it's like, oh, if there's only one of these things roaming around, how could there be so many thousands of tunnels down here? And then he starts running through scenarios, and then he ends up on, like, what if this thing is the last of its kind?
Yeah.
Captain, there are literally thousands of these tunnels in this general area alone. Far too many to be cut by the one creature in an ordinary lifetime.
Then we're dealing with more than one creature, despite your tricorder readings. Or we have a creature with an extremely long lifespan.
Or it is the last of a race of creatures which made these tunnels. If so... If it is the only survivor of a dead race, to kill it would be a crime against science.
Mr. Spock, our mission is to protect this colony, to get the Pergeum moving again. This is not a zoological expedition. Maintain a constant reading on the creature. If we have to, we'll use our phasers to cut our own tunnels. We'll try to surround it. I'm sorry, Mr. Spock, but I'm afraid the creature must die.
I see no alternative myself, Captain. It merely seems a pity.
Oh, also, they scanned and they can't find any life, right? And then he's also like, oh, it's
that we know
scanning
of.
Carbon. Right. Yes. Okay, right. Yes, that's all.
And this is the spot where, like, you know, Spock's like, I don't know if it's a great idea to kill this thing, considering it might be the only one of its kind left. And Kirk is just very, very matter of fact, like, it's killed 50 people. We need this per GM.
And we need this. Like, we need to get these machines on.
Like, just very blunt. A lot of just like, we have to kill it. It has to die.
Mm-hmm. And I will say, he's not completely unsympathetic, because after he sees how Spock reacts, he's kind of, if I remember correctly, he's kind of like, look, I understand where you're coming from, but like, these are my orders. This is what we have to do. And Spock kind of goes with it. It's like, okay, I get it. Fine.
Yeah. Also, there's a very weird swerve or like weird change in tone in the middle of this episode where like, it's kind of like we've come across the like fundamental moral tension of this episode of like, does this thing need to die or should we protect it because it's unique life? And like Kirk tries to send Spock back to help with like the reactor that's this thing has stolen like a piece of the station's reactor, by the way, which they're looking for. And he's like, he orders Spock to go back and help Scotty with the reactor.
And they do. And we like, do get a quick good scene and one of the first examples of we need Scotty to do something kind of impossible very quickly.
Sure. Yes. So there's that, but there's also this is where Spock, like, I thought it was going to turn into this like tense, like Kirk is trying to order Spock away from the scene because he suspects Spock is going to subvert his orders to save this thing's life. And then instead it just turns into this ridiculous moment of like Spock spouting extremely complicated odds of their survival to Kirk, because really his rationale is just like, well, we're the two commanding officers. We can't both be in the same place in case we die together. So you have to go back. And then Spock's like, oh, the odds of that happening are blah, 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 blah. Like, And it turns into this weird lighthearted music comedy bit of Kirk essentially just being like, oh, Spock, you're so Spock. I guess we can go together. Like,
yeah,
well, if those are the odds, then I guess it's fine.
Yeah.
Mr. Spock, you are second in command. This will be a dangerous hunt. Either one of us by himself is expendable. Both of us are not.
Captain, there are approximately 100 of us engaged in this search against one creature. The odds against you and I both being killed are 2,228.7 to 1.
2,228.7 to 1? Those are pretty good odds, Mr. Spock.
And they are, of course, accurate, Captain.
Of course. Well, I hate to use the word, but logically, with those kind of odds, you might as well stay. But please stay out of trouble, Mr. Spock.
That is always my intention, Captain.
Yeah, I was like, oh, wow, they're building up some, like, interesting, like, tension in the command structure here. And then, oh, no, not at all. Never mind.
Okay, because I was on the same page as you, and I just thought they Spocked his way out of it. You know, like, and Kirk did want to get him out of there because he was worried Spock was more interested in the academic side.
I think that might have been the initial intent, but like when Spock was so matter of fact about like, well, actually, there's really no reason. And like, it's basically Kirk had no excuse at that point.
Also, his odds are BS because he basically says, this is how many people are down here. This is how many tunnels there are. The odds of us both dying are this. And then they are together in the next scene, searching together in like the tunnels. And then he says, you want to split up down these two tunnels? Which is like, dude, your odd making Spock here are maybe a little off if you're just going to be searching together. I think they literally hear the monster and they're together in the same room.
Yeah.
Your odds are 1 to 1. You're both going to die.
But they do run into the creature.
Yeah. Is that before or after they split up? I don't remember.
It's before because they're together when they shoot it.
Right. Okay. Yes.
And
so yeah, they have attuned their phasers to work on this thing and they get a good hit in.
Yeah. And it scurries off into the darkness down one of those tunnels that it seems to make instantly.
Yeah.
That is one of the redone special effects for this episode is the effect of the tunnel being created.
Okay. Oh, interesting. I thought they only had redone like external ship space shots for this restoration. I did because I remember thinking like, that's a weirdly really good effect for that thing emerging from the wall for 1960s special effects. But I didn't realize they had touched that up.
Yeah, there's certain things they left alone, but that like and actually the episode after this, there's a lot more stuff that they added and redid. Yeah, including like the Klingon battles, but. But yes, that is like the one kind of non-space-based effect that they changed.
Hmm.
But yeah, they wound it, and then they're hunting for it again. That is, I believe, when they split up, and they go down the different tunnels.
And then Kirk ends up in like the... Should I just say it?
Yeah.
The egg chamber.
Yes.
The birthing chamber, full of the little spheroids. And then there are some really ridiculous, cheesy monster movie shots of like... The roof caving in with, like, the silhouette of the creature in the foreground, like, pushing a column of rock over.
Yes.
And stuff.
But he is not injured. Yeah. He's fine. But he is cut off from Spock, and so Spock has to kind of take the long way around. And he's cornered by the creature. But then he points the gun at the creature, and the creature seems to know what that means. And there's some real good, okay, I'm doing my fucking, you know, Chris Pratt, to the hands up to the raptor, kind of like, hey, everything's cool. Everything's fine.
This should have been for the Ramblecast. I watched about the first 20 minutes of Jurassic World.
Okay.
So I immediately now know exactly what you're referring to, and wow, I couldn't make it much further than that.
What if I told you that's the best scene in that movie?
Wow. Okay, moving on.
Anyway, nothing about that, but yes, he has managed to... at least creates some kind of detent here with the creature where when he puts the gun down, it starts to advance a little bit. He puts the gun up, it backs off. And then after a while, he's able to sit down and the creature does not attack him.
It's like some interesting standoff stuff that's only slightly subverted by how ridiculous the creature looks and moves.
Yes.
But and there is some tension there.
There's some tension there. And eventually Spock shows up. And I will say, I think it's to the episode's credit that it does not take any further convincing at this point for Kirk. Like, he sees the behavior, he understands what's going on here, and he realizes there's more intelligence going on here than just you know, the murder monster that he has been led to believe is down here.
Yeah. Yeah. He doesn't even need Spock to do what Spock is about to do to confirm suspicions.
But he does have Spock do it anyway, because if you can Vulcan your way out of a problem, you might as well, right?
That's right. God, Spock really is just like a Swiss Army knife plot device sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, in much the way that Data kind of was in Next Generation, we've talked about this before, but I think, you know, here it's like, because aliens, there aren't as many to pull from, like, it's interesting. They can just give the Vulcans whatever powers they want.
Yeah, the thing I'll say for Data's plausibility, at least, is that all of his strengths are just those of a machine.
Yes.
Like, mechanical strength and computation and stuff. Spock just has magic powers sometimes.
He just has all the alien things you need them to have.
Yeah.
And he does a mind meld, but it feels a little bit more like a Starship Troopers, you know, it's afraid.
Yeah. It's afraid. Yeah.
It's afraid.
But it's in pain is what he actually discovers.
Pain.
He's getting waves of intense pain.
Waves and waves of searing pain. It's in agony.
For us not to kill it, or promise that it won't kill us.
I don't know, Captain. Evidently, it gained an immediate knowledge of us from its empathy with me. In my brief contact with the creature's mind, I discovered it as a highly intelligent, extremely sophisticated animal, in great pain, of course, because of its wound, but not reacting at all like a wounded creature. It calls itself a Horta.
Yes.
Yeah. Not only, I mean, they show the wound on this thing pretty explicitly.
And it looks like it's just like cauterized,
This raw, white, gooey rock-looking bit. But then also, I think, like, emotional pain, because he reveals very quickly what you have certainly come to expect by now, which is that those spheroids are eggs.
What?
And the thing I didn't expect is that it's actually, like, a matter of course for this thing, that the species' entire race dies out as, like, every, what?
50,000
years.
50,000 years?
Yeah. There's another weird little Mass Effect thing. like, every 50,000 years, this species filters down to one being that has to then, like,
nurse shepherd.
Thousands of eggs to essentially bring the next generation of its species about.
Like, vaguely cicada-like in that way, in that there are generations born, you know, and there's sort of like a queen bee or something. There's a queen bee there that it becomes the mother figure to all the offspring. But because these humans have been mucking around down here, they've just been breaking these eggs all willy-nilly, and that really pissed it off.
And saddened it. The Horta saddened the Horta.
They are called the Horta. This is all divined from very stilted things coming out of Spock's mouth.
It's like a I don't know, when they do this with Spock, I like it. Like when they put Spock, you know, he plays the computer a lot, and when they let him just Leonard Nimoy just kind of open up and the raw emotion flows, it works for me. It might seem corny, but it works.
Yeah, I mean, look.
I think Nimoy is great in this show.
He is. And
the mind meld goes a little both ways, right? There's a little seeping back the other way. Is that
how
we get?
It seems like it, yeah. Like, Spock says as much that, like, I think it got as much from me as I got from it.
Because So it kind of understands a bit and then also communicates in writing. Like,
I can't decide if I love that or, I mean, both. Like, I love that part, and it's also completely ridiculous.
Yes, it etches the words, no kill I, into the rock.
It goes and writes in acid on the rock wall to try to talk to them.
Yeah, listen, and it works. You know, it's very effective.
And then the other best part of the episode immediately happens when they bring McCoy down.
Oh my gosh.
To try to heal it.
There's like two great parts here. There's McCoy coming down here and them being like, you need to heal this wound. And this is, by the way, this is the first instance.
Is it?
Okay. Is it really?
Yes, this is the first instance of the catchphrase.
I'm a doctor, not a bricklayer.
Dude, I fucking, like, you got it in one.
Yep.
Like, I don't care what else he has to say. He's never going to top that one.
Nope.
So we've gotten a he's dead Jim. Mm-hmm. We've gotten a I'm a blank, not, I'm a doctor, not a blank.
It's just so shitty and dismissive toward this other, like, entire unique form of life.
But I also understand his consternation about it, because he doesn't know what to do with any of this.
Yeah.
It's not what he knows.
He says it's made of stone and, like, yeah. But like, he figures it out.
Well, he has an idea. And I would just, before we get to what that idea is, I will say the other part of this episode I love is the fact that the miners are now being held at bay. Because they are literally wielding clubs and basically want to Frankenstein villager their way in there to burn the castle down and kill this creature.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. And
they do not care what it is or what its plight is. They're just like, fucking, it killed 50 of our men. Like, we're gonna fucking go in there and kill it.
Yeah. And they gotta get back to work. And also, I mean, there's the ticking clock of, if they don't figure this out, what's the problem with them beaming everybody to the Enterprise? Because he's like, if we don't figure this out, we'll have to beam you all to the Enterprise.
The reactor, because the creature stole that piece of the reactor, so like the life support is going to fail.
The radiation is going to seep in.
And radiation is going
to
come in.
But there's like, there's a point where he's just like, we'll have to beam everybody off of here. Is it just because they need the resources? Is that why it's a kind of a...
Well, they refuse to leave. Like, they're just like, we're not going anywhere. We're not leaving. Okay. But then he's like... But then Kirk is like, hey, the more of you who go to the ship, the longer the life support will last.
Yes. I forgot that line. Yes. Okay. Yes. And they're full on clubs and ready to go and basically take this monster down.
Yep.
Which I think maybe leads to my favorite part. I think, Brad, you were kind of alluding to this, which is when they fool the Enterprise crew by basically being like, who's that over there? And then club a guy in the back of the head.
Just conk, dead, go.
And they rush in, and there's a very quick reveal of, like, this monster's smart, and you're killing babies. And they're like, well, shucks, we didn't mean to do that.
Is this before or after McCoy has healed it by smearing
he's in the process while this is happening.
This is before, because then Spock goes, well, this all might be moot because it's injured and it might be dead. Cut to McCoy, hands up like he's been in a diaper. Like,
oh, it doesn't look good.
It doesn't. His two hands up covered in goo, like he's been elbow deep in the thing or something. Uh-huh. And his face is just like, it's maybe my favorite part of Star Trek so far.
I'm a god, motherfucker.
Yeah. Jim, I might be able to heal a rainy day or something like that.
I might be able to cure a rainy day, I believe, is what he says, yes.
I think I'm a god. I've cured this thing.
It's preceded by a bit where McCoy is on the radio with someone, and he's like, I don't care if it makes no sense that I want this thing. Send it down right goddamn now. I'm your superior officer. And what he was asking for, apparently, was some kind of silicon cement?
Yeah, like construction materials.
Yeah.
Thermal concrete is what this says.
And he uses that to patch up the wound, and it works.
And he loves, he has made a mess, and he loves it. And he says that it'll patch it up until the wound heals.
Yes.
So, like, gosh, that's my favorite moments. That that image of him is just fantastic. That, and maybe the Kirk holding the phallic.
Yes.
Thing, or maybe my favorite images so far.
It's pretty good, and I appreciate that they don't stretch out the, hey, the creature is in peril from these miners thing, because literally, as soon as they walk in and Kirk lays it out for them, they really are just like,
aww,
we done bad.
Well, I mean, there's that, but there's also the part where Kirk immediately is just like, I bet it'll work together with you. Yes. Like, this thing moves through rock the way that we move through air. Like, if you just let it do the tunneling for you, you can just follow behind and get all those tasty minerals.
Just, you know, don't kill its children. I feel like that's a pretty good deal.
Yeah. Like, we're sorry, and yeah, that might work.
But it does have one of my favorite little coda moments in any of these episodes so far, which is when they call back to the guy on the planet, and they're like, hey, how's it going down there? And he's like, well, once you get past how they look, they're actually doing a real good job, so everything's great. We're fine. Everything's happy.
Well, not only that, he's like, Jim, you're not going to believe the amount of shit we found out. Gold and diamond. Like,
yeah.
Who would say, I'm afraid to tell you how much we found down here. Mm-hmm. Another hint to, like, the profiteering. And
the mother load. You
know, yeah, they are going to be rich, boys.
Yep.
Which makes me wonder, you know, what's the one, Upper Decks? What's the cartoon one where they kind of
spoof
decks.
On
Lower Decks. Of, like, do they go back there and find that they have been exploiting these poor creatures for centuries
now? Have the
now?
Creatures unionized?
Yeah, have the creatures unionized?
They should.
Because they're basically, he says, man, they just wake up, start digging tunnels, and we found gold.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, they're back on the Enterprise. It's all good.
It's extra funny because later in Star Trek, gold is basically deemed to be worthless. Like, gold is the thing they use to press around this other element called latinum, which is super valuable, but the gold itself is basically worthless.
Also, isn't that basically just a currency that they use to kind of deal with other cultures?
Yes. Like, Ferengi are big on gold press latinum,
yes. Okay. Like, in case you need to pay off the Ferengi, it's good to have some around, but they don't really use it for anything themselves.
Yeah.
But were you, Alex, were you getting at Spock's retort?
Well, no, there? I love the part where they call down to the planet, and it's like, actually, everything's fine, these guys are great, they're ugly as shit, but whatever. And then, yes, they cut back to the ship, and they're like, well, actually, when I was, you know, they think we're as ugly as we think they are, and also they said that my ears were the only feature they thought was interesting on our feature, so actually I'm pretty cool. I don't know if you know that.
You know, the Horta aren't so bad once you get used to their appearance.
Well, that's about it, Kirk. Thanks for everything.
Our pleasure, Chief. Kirk out.
Curious. What Chief Vandenberg said about the Horta is exactly what the mother Horta said to me. She found humanoid appearance revolting, but she thought she could get used to it.
Oh, she did she? Now tell me, did she happen to make any comment about those ears?
Not specifically. But I did get the distinct impression she found them the most attractive human characteristic of all. I didn't have the heart to tell her that only I have...
She really liked those ears?
Captain, the Horta is a remarkably intelligent and sensitive creature with impeccable taste.
Because she approved of you?
Really, Captain, my modesty...
Does not bear close examination, Mr. Spock. I suspect you're becoming more and more human all the time.
Captain, I see no reason to stand here and be insulted.
Ahead, warp factor 2.
Yes, and then Kirk calls him out on his pride, right? Mm-hmm. Or his modesty. And
it's another, like, you don't have to insult me.
Yeah. Yes, you're becoming more human every day. Mm-hmm. I don't have to stand here and be insulted. Oh, it's a fun episode.
It's a good one.
It's good.
Yeah.
For a show, for a creature design that rough, I will say, I feel like they managed to get a lot out of it, and I think the moral center of the episode is pretty rock solid. Ha.
Show feels it really feels like it's hit its stride in the last, like, 4 or 5 in a row have all been, like, very solid and just well executed.
Yeah.
In a way that a lot of the earlier episodes were, like, kind of messy.
Yes. And I feel like this next one we're about to get to here in a second is maybe a little bit more of a throwback to some of the issues from earlier in the season. But it's got its moments. I'm talking about Errand of Mercy, and we will be talking about that one when we come back. And we are back, and it is time. I was going to say the auspicious debut. I'm not sure it's that auspicious, but it is time for the debut of the Klingons in Errand of Mercy.
Yeah, they really just kind of throw it in there. It's like the third line of the episode is just like, oh, negotiations with the Klingon Empire, blah, 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 or something. Like, no preamble.
Down.
No real setup about who the Klingons are. Off the bat.
Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting because, again, with the Romulans, you get this big preamble about, like, how weird the dynamic was with them and how fucked up that war was with them.
There's history established with humanity and stuff.
But
and
that was plot critical, though, because of the space racism of that. Remember that guy? Was it the... Who's the guy who sits next to Sulu?
Navigator.
The Navigator
and,
dude, yeah.
And the whole they look like Spock and the pointy ears and that whole thing.
Yeah. Now, Vinny, okay.
Yeah.
Just real quick here. Uh-huh. What is your familiarity with the Klingons and the dynamic of the Klingons with regards to Star Trek going into this?
Okay, two things. One, Worf. Okay.
Okay.
And the other was, I thought that Khan was a Klingon.
Right. I remember we had that conversation.
Yeah. So I know people have said that they changed like appearances a bit, like, you know, as
pretty drastically. Yes.
But that's about it. Like, okay. You know, I know they're warlike, you know, I know Worf, I know the characterization of Worf. So, honor.
Well, that's the thing is that the next generation version of the Klingons and I would say from like the later original series movies on, this is kind of what the Klingons are, though they're still very much viewed as like treacherous and backstabbing in those movies for the most until six.
I thought they're all honor bound. Can you backstab now? Okay.
That's like, I mean, it's an interesting, well, this is getting off topic. It's an interesting component of Next Generation that Worf was raised by humans and like very much longs for his Klingon roots that he kind of never had.
I didn't know that.
And like
okay.
super duper buys into all the honor type shit. And then when he finally actually gets back there and starts mixing it up with the real Klingons, he finds that, like, the honor stuff, but he never wants to believe it, but the honor stuff is really just a fucking cover. Like, they're all, like, conniving and stabbing each other in the back and vying for power, and none of them actually obey any of the tenets that he has, like, grown up believing in.
Yeah, like, it's kind of a samurai warrior code honor thing, but, like, and there are adherents to it, certainly within Klingon culture, but...
Yes.
But the actual political apparatus of the Klingons is very much just like people constantly shooting for power grabs. They're like powerful families
that are
vying for stuff.
That's a good point that almost all of the Klingons he is interacting with at that point are like the top of society.
The most Machiavellian of them.
Yeah.
But they are warlike.
They are. And especially like, so again, they're very much warlike. They embrace battle. They believe that they will go to their version of Valhalla, which is Stovokor. When they die.
Okay. Klingon names are so good.
They are. The Klingon language is fascinating, and I love the way that like fans and people have developed it over the years.
I just had a copy of Klingon Hamlet that I donated.
Oh, jeez.
Because I realized that I was never actually going to do anything with it.
No, but it's a cool thing to have. But so this vision of the Klingons, this starting vision of them, you don't really see much of any of that character development, like what they introduce here in Aaron of Mercy, and kind of like the other question I was going to ask was, Brad, how much familiarity do you have with this era of Klingons? Because this is pretty different.
Like, I think I've seen like maybe some images of them from this series like a long time ago, but I kind of went out of my way not to look this up before I watched this episode.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of expected more than just dudes in makeup. Like, I had always heard the like, oh, they were. Like, what is the official excuse, or should we, is that in the series and we should wait, or like...
No, the excuse is here.
About the appearance, I mean, like, is it like surgical? Did they say like, oh, the ones that were on the frontier were like...
Oh, canonical, like story-wise?
Were like cosmetically altering their appearance for some reason or something. Isn't there some like half-assed explanation later?
So you might be right about that. Here is what I know for sure. The reason they look like this is because of the makeup budget for the show was nothing at this point.
Yeah, sure.
And it changed dramatically. And the thing is, the version that started to make its way into the films, which is the version that became the Next Generation version.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So like I think the first Klingon you see in one, I can't remember if there's one in motion picture, but like the first big Klingon villain of the movies is in three, and that's the Christopher Lloyd one. And I feel like that is when you see the ridges and the armor, and that's kind of when the Klingon design becomes a lot more codified.
Okay, I've got to look this up. I know we'll get to that movie eventually, but I need to... Oh, wow. Okay, yes, that is just a Next Generation Klingon, like full-on.
So Roddenberry, I think, has said this is more what he envisioned for the Klingons when, like, in terms of like what he wanted them to look like despite not having the budget to do so back then.
Okay.
But the reality is, the design of the Klingons in the script, which is written by Gene L. Coon, he's the one who's credited with coming up with the Klingons, is literally, and I'm using this phrase because this is the phrase he uses in the script, Oriental hard-faced. That's it.
Okay.
So the actual development of the makeup and the design was done by the actor here who plays, what is the character's name?
Core.
Was it Core?
The character's name is Core.
Yeah.
Like Coors without the S is how he says it.
Yeah, Core. So John Colicos, who is the actor who plays him, he worked with the makeup artist Fred Phillips on fleshing out the design and coming up with more of like an actual aesthetic for it. And Colicos is a Canadian actor of Greek descent. That said, he's one of those actors who played a lot of ethnic characters over the years because he kind of had that sort of ambiguous look to him. So he was not above doing, let's just say, brown face or red face in films and that kind of thing. And here, they are straight up going for Genghis Khan. Like, that is what they said they were trying to do.
They're conquerors in this.
The conquerors, like,
They're extremely, like, blatant, blunt imperialists in this. Just
like occupiers, straight up. Yeah, that is their whole thing.
Like, we just fucking... There's even, like, when Kirk is beseeching the occupants of this planet that we'll get to let the Federation help defend them from the Klingons, he goes into this pretty detailed explanation of, like, you don't understand, they are going to cover your planet in vast slave labor camps, and, like, you are just going to become slaves, like, this is what they do. Like, it is, like, a pretty brutal occupation is what he's describing.
Yeah. And so, again, the thing with the Klingons in this era is there really isn't much of a defining characteristic to them other than villainy. Like, they are purely foils for the Enterprise. Their whole society revolves around making the Federation miserable.
And Kirk says at one point, like, their culture is war. Like, it's how they live, you know, like, it is what they do. Like, there is, well, maybe I should get into this when we talk more about the character. There's, like, a cultured aspect to Kor that kind of surprised me compared to some later Klingon depictions.
Yeah.
Like they're a lot more barbarous later on. There's like a manic quality to a lot of Klingons in Next Generation, you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, they are just all about fucking shit up and, like, the glory of battle, and they're probably drunk while they're doing it type stuff.
Yeah.
They're more Viking-like, I feel like, later on.
Yes.
A little
like,
bit.
They still have that warrior code that I think you can definitely draw to, like, you know, to samurai in Japanese, but, like, their vibe is extremely, you know, like, chuckle-fuck Viking warriors that are just, like, sloshing ale, like, around while they fucking stab each other.
Yes, that's exactly it. It's like, we settle disputes by getting drunk and beating each other up.
So to put it in terms I might understand, maybe a little more Krogan-esque.
Sure. Yes, absolutely.
Okay. But like Kor here is, like, almost more this, like, calculating, intelligent, like, thinking villain, like, much more like
Khan, like,
respect my enemies kind of.
So there's a real Shakespearean bent to the biggest Klingon villains that come up throughout, like literally Christopher Plummer's character in Star Trek VI is straight up quoting Shakespeare at various times because he loves Earth fiction. Christopher Plummer or Christopher Lloyd's Klingon in 3 is real over-the-top, like, theatrical villain type. And, you know, Gowron, obviously, from Next Generation, apart from being the kind of bug-eyed weirdo that, like, you described in terms of, like, just being a real wild child, he has that real theatrical quality to him.
Extremely.
There is just a vein of that that kind of runs through the main personalities of the Klingons.
It took me until adulthood, but Gowron eventually became, like, one of my favorite Star Trek characters ever. He's just so goddamn entertaining to watch.
He's wild. I cannot wait till we get to him in 10 years. But
I'll say this on the characterization. Kor is kind of the only one, maybe one or two other people they actually do any other kind of makeup on. The rest, I assume, are also just in kind of grease paint and just walking around
very
in the background.
Very hasty grease paint in some cases.
Most of them just get the makeup. They don't get the eyebrows and the mustache and everything.
So I wasn't sure if, you know,
some of them look downright Irish if they did not have the grease paint on.
Kor, I wasn't sure if that's what they were going on for Klingon or that's just what Kor looks like. You know, I wasn't sure. But you mentioned
the facial
script,
hairstyle becomes a trait of the Klingons, like the kind of, like, various weird mustaches and goatees.
Oh,
and
that
stuff.
Sticks
like,
around?
That sticks around.
Okay.
But, like, less Fu Manchu-y and more, like, they give it its own distinct thing over time. Just a couple of other notes here about the episode. DC Fontana is on record saying she thinks the Romulans were just much more interesting villains.
I agree.
The reason the Klingon stuck around and became the more recurring villain is because they required less makeup.
Okay.
I
wonder, do we have any idea, as of this episode's production, whether they intended for them to be long-running antagonists?
It's mixed, as far as I can tell. Like, there was a desire to have recurring villains, I think. And I think after season one, they settled on the Klingons because they were the easiest ones to costume and makeup up. And they also, you know, I mean, look, while this episode has its problems, I feel like the back and forth between Kirk and Kor,
yeah,
is one of the few things that actually kind of works.
Like, it's good. I mean, it's kind of up there with Khan or other similar villains of, like, Kirk sparring with someone who, or that Romulan commander whose name I can't remember. Mm. Like,
yeah,
like people who see Kirk as an equal and want to, like, do glorious battle against him on equal footing to prove their worth type stuff.
Yeah.
Like some good back and forth.
Last couple of things I will just mention here real fast. Kor comes back in Star Trek. There is a 140-year-old version of him that shows up in 3 episodes of Deep Space Nine. Huh. He was apparently friends with Curzon Dax back in the day, and so Dax has to mix it up with him and a couple of other Klingon dudes in a few episodes.
Huh.
But like old
actor?
Klingons. Yeah, same actor.
Wow.
Are Klingon long-lived?
Generally, I mean, the thing is,
go ahead.
I was saying, you can assume that any character, any alien can live long enough to become plot critical if they need them to be.
But also humans are very long lived at this point. Like Bones is in the pilot of Next Generation and he's like 130 at that point or something, right?
Yeah, and they show him as being very frail and not particularly mobile, but at the same time he is alive and he's able to come to the starship and walk around.
Yeah, he's walking the halls unaided at 130, so like medical science has just advanced a lot at this point.
Okay.
So if you're not killed by a phaser or a disruptor or some sort of weird space disease, you will have a long, full life.
I mean, just go back to that planet with the spores and just...
there you go.
Your spleen just grows back.
Other than Kolokos, who also had a run as Count Baltar on the original Battlestar Galactica, we have John Abbott is Aelborn of the Organians, the planet that is under occupation here by the Klingons. This is another actor who's been around since the 1930s, did a lot of TV acting in the 50s and 60s, and the most noteworthy thing I could find on his catalog is that his final 2 film appearances were in the early 80s in a pair of Jerry Lewis bombs.
Okay.
Slapstick of Another Kind, which Gene Siskel called the worst movie of that year, and Cracking Up, which was the final Jerry Lewis film as a director, which is just a bunch of weird sketches featuring Jerry Lewis. Not maybe how I would want to end my acting career, but hey, you know, we can't always get what we want.
I liked him in this. He had a kind of hangdog, sad quality to it. Almost like a, could have been playing like Robert Downey Jr.'s dad or something like that. Had that like, look.
For the first half of this episode, I was convinced this is the actor from Gabriel Knight 2 who runs the bar. The weird old guy who runs the bar. I thought it was that guy.
Really? Interesting.
Yes.
Okay.
They have that same look, that same kind of like, you know, big features, that deep kind of voice. Okay. Like, I don't know. It just seemed like him, but it is not him.
Okay. Aelborn.
Aelborn, yes. The Organians, this planet of sheep, as Kor calls them. People who are pacifist to a weird degree. They live in this on this planet, and they have this village that has the look of, you know, kind of an old-timey village.
Yeah, here we are with just another, I don't know, maybe they built this set for this episode, I doubt it, but it sure does feel like another backlot situation of just like, well, we've got this medieval castle set here, you can use this for a week.
This episode might be the least one I understand. So as we go through this, I'll try and avoid asking every single weird plot question.
No, please do, because this one has some holes in it.
There's a fortress on there. Is the fortress ever explained why it's there?
No, okay. They straight up say when they beam down, like, that structure over there does not line up with what we know of this planet.
Yeah.
We should probably go check that out.
But they never kind of say why there's a fortress or a dungeon
do at the end, but
every question can just be explained by the reveal at the end of this.
Right. By the astronomical hand wave of the whole thing.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Well, I mean, it seemed increasingly likely, and about halfway through, I was sure that they were building up to a reveal with the people.
They absolutely were. Like, it's obvious from the jump, but
yeah,
okay.
But they take long time getting there.
It's more the nature of the reveal.
Yeah.
Once we get there, but anyway.
They live in this village. It's very old timey. They're living in, you know, like it's. I mean, I would say it's somewhat agrarian. It's a lot of people with like farm animals and just kind of mucking around in the muck.
They use some Star Trek lingo to tell you what kind of civilization they are, but I forget what it was. Like, this is a class or on the something scale. This is the...
Yeah, but they call them stagnant at one point.
It's the Richter scale of civilizations or something, or societies or something like that, which I thought was, I'm pretty sure it was Richter, wasn't it?
It could be. I mean, there's multiple Richter scales, but...
Are there?
I don't know. Okay. But regardless, they don't rank very highly.
Here it is, the Richter scale of culture.
Oh, is that not a Star Trek? Do we not come back to that?
It also, let's not get into this, but I'm not clear what the difference is between Memory Alpha and Memory Beta. On Memory Beta here, a method of describing, quantifying, and comparing the development and achievement of numerous disparate cultures on different worlds.
Unfortunately, their world, though, is at the intersection. It's a strategic location. Is that what the problem is?
Yes, they live on the corner of Federation and Klingon.
Yeah.
Also, I don't know if we mentioned Spock goes and does some studies around the village and comes back and says, like, this is a truly stagnant culture. Yes. Like, there are signs that nothing has changed here for thousands or tens of thousands
of
years.
I think he says like 10,000 years.
Yeah.
Like, not progressing.
To him, that seems like an impossibility that something like that could exist.
Right. And then they immediately go and meet up with like the closest thing to leadership in this society, who they, again, like I said, are like beseeching as hard as possible to like, hey, these people are going to enslave you.
Let us help you.
Over if they show up before we do. Just we'll help you, we'll help you build defensive structures, we'll train your people, we'll like give you a whole new blah blah blah. You know, you're gonna lose your entire life and culture and everything if you don't let us help defend you. And they're like, we cannot, I'm sorry, we just can't do it.
Okay, what happens happens, man. You should leave, I think they say. Like, you should probably
It's kind of, ironically, it wouldn't have mattered if they had said yes, because the Klingons show up 5 minutes later anyway, in force. And I have to say, the reveal of Kor walking in, he fucking introduces himself as the military governor of Organia. He quite literally walks in and says, hey, I'm the ruler of your planet.
Yeah.
What's up?
You're going to listen to me now.
This is the ruling council.
I am Eobor, temporary head of the council. I bid you welcome.
No doubt you do. I am Kor, military governor of Organia. Who are you?
Oh, he is Barona, one of our leading citizens.
And he has no tongue?
I have a tongue.
Good. You will be taught how to use it. Where is your smile?
My what?
The stupid, idiotic smile everyone else seems to be wearing. A Vulcan. Do you also have a tongue?
I am Spock, a dealer in Kivas and Trillium.
You do not look like a storekeeper. Take this man. Vulcans are members of the Federation. He may be a spy.
He's no spy.
Well, have we a ram among the sheep? You object to us taking him?
He's done nothing. Nothing at all.
Coming from an Organian, yours is practically an act of rebellion. Very good.
Also, Sulu's got control of the ship in like kind of a pretty, you know, what Kirk tells him, like, you guys get outnumbered, you need to get out of there. But
yeah.
This is another kind of small away team, so.
Yeah, I just love the swagger of him coming in and immediately running everything.
Yep.
It's so ridiculous.
I mean, I guess they
beam
down,
it's really
down,
just
right?
Kirk and Spock, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah. And they're kind of in costume, or not costume, but in disguise at this point, or is that only after the Klingons show up that they assume identities for themselves?
It is after, they once they realize the Klingons are on the planet, the people are like, all right, well, we'll just get you some clothes, because you need to blend in.
Yeah.
The Vulcan's going to be a problem. We'll figure that out. Don't worry. We'll call him a traitor.
Yeah. They basically just come up with personas where Kirk is like part of the society and Spock is a roaming Vulcan merchant.
There are merchants in our culture. You know?
Yeah.
The one thing I will say is that they added all that a bunch of stuff to that battle scene that happens early on where the Klingon battlecruisers show up and they start attacking. You don't actually see what a Klingon ship looks like, I think, until season two.
Oh, interesting.
Ah.
Oh,
in the original run, anyway.
That is a lot to add, then, because there are some pretty clear views of their ships in this.
I think the only thing you got in the original episode was shots of the Enterprise being hit.
Huh.
Because I think they didn't have the model budget to build a new ship for that.
Oh, right, yeah, at the top of the episode, too, they just blast the Klingon ship to pieces. Before they beam down. Yeah, it's on.
Because the thing they establish is that whatever treaty talks have broken down, there was a war with the Klingons 10 years prior that had sort of, you know, reached an armistice. But in the middle of all of that, they just get a message like, yo, war's on.
Yeah.
We're on. We're back on it.
Get down there. Secure this place.
Yeah. And so, yes, they are pleading with these people, desperate to let them know that, like, hey, your way of life is about to be changed irreparably if you don't, you know, let us help you. There's definitely a tinge of colonialist in the way that Kirk is explaining this stuff. He's like, we'll give you everything you need to get your society going and we'll make it better.
Medicine and like roads.
Yeah. And just no interest in anything they have to say. But at the same time, the way they are responding with just, you know, blithe smiles and no real interest in what they have to say is very confusing.
That's like everyone involved immediately just develops this like deep contempt for these people because they've just got this like dumb placid smile on their faces all the time and like barely even respond to reason.
There's one
and like even Kirk, like this is toward the end, but even Kirk is like, I am used to the idea of dying, but I have no interest in dying for the likes of you.
Yeah.
Like, even Kirk, like, wants nothing to do with them because he sees them as such pushovers.
There's, like, one weird tell, I think, during this exchange where one guy does, like, a telepathic, they're here, or they've landed, right?
They've landed with X number of people.
Yeah.
And they're like, how does he know that? And he's like, just trust it. Like,
he's very perceptive.
If he says it, then
he
it's
knows.
True.
Yeah, he knows.
Yeah.
So clearly there's something extrasensory going on here. There is something about them that makes it so that, like, the idea of this occupation really doesn't seem to bother them in any particular way. But you're right. Like, nobody can seem to figure out what that is, and it's just pissing them off further and further as the episode goes along. Because I think deep down, I mean, the Klingons, it makes sense, as a warlike culture, would find this whole thing kind of offensive.
Uh-huh.
But, like, I think to maybe Kirk and people like him, the idea that anyone could be this happy and this blissfully unaware of what goes on in the universe is just like, God damn you. How dare you? I have to put up with this bullshit and this is how you live?
Yeah. Kirk, it's more of the typical Kirk, like, you know, fire of the human spirit type stuff. In Kor's case, at one point, he just seems pissed off that these are the people that he's going to rule over.
Yes. Like, boring.
Like, it's some backwater that he should have something far more glorious to deal with.
Right.
But the initial interaction between Kirk and Kor, where Kirk is really doing a bad job of pretending to be an Organian, and also, you know, Spock is sort of like going through the motions of like, yes, I am this traitor. I trade this thing.
That's
what I do.
Right. Trilithium or whatever.
Yeah. I think the stuff with Kor and Kirk is good because you can tell Kor doesn't buy it. Like, he's like, yeah, all right. Oh, you're just like these people? Weird. You seem kind of pissy.
Yeah.
I've never met a pissy Organian before. What's going on here?
Baroner? Is that his name?
Baroner.
Baroner.
Yeah.
Baroner.
Baroner.
A real Baroner there.
Yeah. Yeah. Kirk's just like, I guess whatever, man. Just want to get off my back. Just go take these people over. Like, I think Kirk the whole time is also very frustrated he's gonna fail this mission. Like, he is, it is not gonna work out, and he just sees the odds more and more stacked. He's basically trapped on this planet because Sulu has to get the hell out of there.
Yeah, because there's like 17 Klingon ships like surrounding this planet,
and like I think he kind of thinks that's it, game over. Like, he's now a basically a prisoner of war.
Pretty much. But he has to pretend that, like, he's a prisoner that is just one of them, as opposed to a Federation person who they will almost assuredly torture and kill.
Yes.
And I don't want to spend a ton of time just, like, recounting the plot of this one, because it really just kind of repeats beats over and over again.
Yeah,
it does. A lot of ideas and almost straight-up dialogue are repeated.
And it's like the one thing they kind of do is that, like, Kirk and Spock decide they're going to start a little insurrection, and they're going to get the people behind them by blowing up an ammo depot. And then they go to the Organians, and they're like, all right, so, like, yeah, we did that. You're gonna come help us now. And he's like, you shouldn't have done that. You really shouldn't have done that.
We cannot permit violence of any kind.
And he's like, aren't you inspired? Come on. Like, no, man. Haven't you seen The Great Escape? We are supposed to do this. But this hurts me in my soul that you did this. Yeah.
Of course we blew it up. Deliberately.
But that was violence.
We did it to show that you could fight back, that you don't have to be sheep, you can be wolves.
Terrible. To destroy.
History is full of examples of civil populations fighting back successfully against a military dictatorship. We may not be able to destroy the Klingons, but we can tie them up, blow up their installations, disrupt their communications, make Organia useless to them.
Our fleet will eventually arrive. In the meantime, the battle is ours. It can be a successful one.
Captain, I implore you never to do such a thing again.
Why? Are you afraid of retribution? Does your personal freedom mean so little to you?
How little you understand us, Captain.
All I understand is that you apparently don't have the backbone to stand up and fight and protect the ones you love. I speak of courage, gentlemen. Does courage mean so little to you? Speak of courage.
Obviously, you do not know the difference between courage and foolhardiness.
Always it is the brave ones who die, the soldiers. I hope you will continue to savor the sweetness of your life. You disgust me.
What are you going to do with him, Commander?
What is always done with spies and saboteurs, he will be killed. After he has had first-hand experience of our mind scanner.
There is no need to use your machine on him, Commander. I can tell you his name. It is Captain James T. Kirk.
Elborn.
What?
Captain of the USS Enterprise. A starship commander. And his first officer? I had hoped to meet you in battle, but...
For some reason, he feels that he must destroy you, Commander. Just as you feel you must destroy him.
That's going to be rather difficult now. Isn't it, Captain?
Is this around the time that the Organians revealed the identity of them to the Klingons?
No, that's later.
Is that later? I thought that was before they take him prisoner.
Well, I'm trying to remember, because there's a few, again, stuff started kind of repeats in this episode, but like there's the bit where they're taken prisoner, but then he takes Kirk because he's going to be like, you're going to be my liaison to these fucking people. And he explains his mind ripper device, which they are going to use on Spock to try and find out who he really is. But Vulcans can outsmart the mind ripper device because of course they can.
Of course they can.
Minds are too complicated.
Uh-huh.
And then they do the blow up of the depot, and then eventually, but also at the same time, Kor has surveillance devices everywhere. You see him watching on a TV screen, him like Kirk and Spock basically just saying everything that they really are.
Right.
Even before the Organians come along and be like, actually, that's Captain Kirk and that's Spock. They're from the Enterprise.
Right. Yes. That's right.
Yeah, he busts in and he's like, surveillance? He's like, I know, or something. He's spouts something back to him. Like, your courage.
The streets is always watching.
Courage or something like that. Yeah. And then there's the good reveal where Kor just has to hear Kirk's name, and then he's like, Captain of the Enterprise. It's like, oh, okay, everybody knows Kirk.
Does he say the Captain of the Enterprise?
Captain of the Enterprise.
He absolutely knows who this guy is. Yeah. And like, I think he basically says something like, well, we can't kill him now. Like, he's too important to just kill.
Yeah.
He knows things that we need.
Put him in the Mind Ripper. Yeah. Rip his mind.
And they threaten to, but they never get around to it. No, we never actually see the Mind Ripper happen.
No, they're also going to dissect Spock, and that doesn't happen either, because they need to know how he can, they basically throw him in a dungeon.
Yeah, literal dungeon.
They have their little, meeting of the minds, and then they throw him in a dungeon. He's got 6 hours. They're also like, this is another
12-hour deadline.
They've got a ticking clock before they're going to mind rip him, and then they throw them both in the fortress dungeon, and then they're broken out by the Organian.
I mean, considering the way these people are, it's weird enough that they have a fortress. It's especially weird that they would have a dungeon.
This is what I'm saying. Why is this thing here?
We'll get there.
Yeah.
But they're running out of time. They're expecting to die, but then the door opens, and who is there? None other than our guy. Whose name I totally forgot there for a second. Aelborn.
Yeah.
And he's just like, they're going to do violence to you, so we got to let you go. We got to get you out of here, because we can't sanction that.
Yeah, and I think we skipped over it. They've already supposedly executed 200 citizens of the planet.
I think that's after they escape, isn't it? Because don't they ramp things up to be like, turn them over?
Yes, that happens, right. Because once they escape and Kor gets word of that, he's like, we're going to execute 200 of you every 2 hours until they are found.
Right. Yes. It's the next stage of he's like, take it up to stage 4.
And then, in the middle of that whole scuttlebutt, they fucking choke out his right hand man, just straight up just leave the rope around that dude's neck. Was just asking him questions. And that dude folds like a blanket.
But that's when Kirk and Spock are like, okay, listen, if you're not going to do anything, we're going to go stop this entire invasion, the two of us by ourselves. And they're like, you're going to die. He's like, this is basically Kirk's contempt at that point, right? That's what he says, the thing that you said, Brad, which is like, I don't want to die.
I don't want to
die for you, but I got to do something. Whatever, man. I'm going to go die in battle.
Did you hear them?
Yes, of course, Captain. But nothing has changed.
Well, Mr. Spock, it seems it's up to you and me.
It would appear so, Captain.
The Federation has invested a great deal of money in our training. They're about due for a small return, and we have 2 hours with which to do it in.
But only 2. More Organians will die.
No, Mr. Spock, no more will die on account of us. Where are those faces?
I cannot tell you.
You've told us a great deal about how you hate violence. Unless you tell me where those faces are, you're going to have more violence than you know what to do with.
You mean you would actually use force?
It's entirely up to you.
Aelborn, this is of no matter. Perhaps you better let him have what he wants. He...
Very well, but it will do you no good. They are in that cabinet.
Gentlemen, I have no great love for you, your planet, your culture. Despite that, Mr. Spock and I are going to go out there and quite probably die in an attempt to show you that there are some things worth dying for.
But there are only 2 of you against an army. Don't you realize that what you intend to do will be hopeless?
Come on, Mr. Spock, let's get out of here.
Brave men.
Yes, but so foolish.
Interesting, however.
Of course, we cannot allow it. To stop them is very bad.
It is necessary. They may harm one another.
Fain.
They will wait until darkness.
And then?
Terrible, inconceivable, savage.
We will wait.
But eventually there's some sort of come together. There's the fleets are in space. Yeah. They're getting ready to battle. It's all going down, man.
There's a standoff on the planet between Kirk and Spock and some Klingons with weapons.
And Kor. Kor is in there.
Kor storms in there. And it's just like, all right, it's all going down. It's all going down. And then snap your fingers, it's not.
Everybody throw their hands up in the air.
The visual of everybody just flinging their hands away from...
Hot potato!
that's exactly what it is.
Too hot.
They all hot potato both their weapons and, like, each other, even when they resort to trying to punch each other, and even then, they're just like, oh, we can't touch each other. What's going on here? And then a shot on the bridge of the Enterprise with the same thing. They're all hot potatoing the control surface of the bridge.
Oh, and there's also, once Kirk and Spock leave, isn't there the scene of the Council of Organians be like, all right, man, take a deep breath. This one's going
to
be...
They're all
like in deep contemplation for a second before all this happens.
Then there's the big reveal. Then there's this reveal.
Yeah, which of course, you know, at this point, something supernatural is going on. But the specific mechanism of what they did, I think, is hilarious.
And so far reaching.
Yeah, they make any and all weapon of war, I think, is the phrase they use, which I guess could include fists.
Mm-hmm.
Emanate a temperature of 350 degrees.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, yes, nobody can touch a weapon anymore or hit each other.
And not only do they do that there, but at one point, Aelborn is like, I'm actually astrally projecting onto Earth and the Klingon homeworld, and I'm going to do that shit to all your stuff there, too.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so they're like, okay, quite literally, you can no longer fight each other.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout the galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just going to stop this war right now.
And they're all just like, all right, what the fuck?
And it's interesting because obviously Kor's reaction makes sense. He's real pissed off. He's like, how dare you? How dare you get in the middle of all this? But Kirk is like kind of bloodthirsty at this point too. And he's kind of losing it.
Yeah, I was a little surprised to see how much Kirk still wanted to just fight. But
they have put him through it in this episode, so I understand why he's pissed off. But like, the sheer reach of what they are trying to say they are doing here is so ridiculous.
It's pretty powerful.
This I'm sorry.
Well, he also predicts like the future, right? Doesn't he say in the future you'll be friends? Like you should
fight. You'll work
together. I can't remember if that was before or after they kind of concede who they are finally. But yeah, that one really stood out to me because I was just like, did they write the dynamics in Next Generation the way they did purely on the promise of this one prediction? Like, did they feel like they had to make good on that? Because that's exactly what happens.
Oh, are they friends in it? I thought it was kind of like a...
They're allies.
They are. Yeah. Okay, I didn't know
there's
that.
A little bit of tension here and there, but generally the Federation and the Klingons are allies in Next Generation.
Interesting. Okay.
It takes some real work to get there, but they do get there.
Yeah, but I don't know, man. This might be one too many omnipotent being episodes for me.
I'm with you, and I think, like, the explanation for this one is the stupidest one yet.
Like, there's barely even an explanation. They basically just say, like, it took us millions of years to evolve beyond physical forms, now we're beings of pure energy, and blah, blah, blah.
And violence hurts our souls.
Yes.
Like, but, God, what is this, like, the fifth episode or something now, where they've just had some godlike being?
I will say this is the only one that Information Society straight up sampled for a song. But yes, this is the pure energy part is part of a song of theirs. But yeah, like the explanation here is they are beings of pure energy, pure light. They have evolved over millions of years. And the only reason they are in physical form on this planet is because they want to exist in an unassuming way, so they present themselves this way, so people will just leave them alone, but also so that they have a familiar cultural touchstone, so they know what they are and assume that they should leave them alone.
That makes no sense.
If you were a being of pure energy, why are you even here?
Or, like, you didn't do that for the Klingons. They projected themselves as, like, a human civilization from a time period. They didn't project
Although, keep in mind, remember, like, 90% of aliens just look like humans at this point.
But I'm saying, like,
including the Klingons.
The Klingons, they should have projected themselves as some cultural touchstone for the Klingons, right? Like, when
the Federation got there first.
They're not that powerful. I don't understand, really. Are the people that are around, are they projections of mapped, like, versions of themselves? Or is the Council the only beings that are projecting?
I think that they are, okay, it's never explained. The gist I get is that there are multiple life forms there. The reason they don't care that 200 of their citizens just died is because they didn't die. They just yeeted out their physical existence, like, back to energy. We'll see you later when you come back around.
So you think, you're trying to tell me, Alex Navarro, that when somebody comes to visit, the Organians have to basically go...
No,
Renfair role play as people carting bread around on the streets.
No, they just do that because they don't have anything else to do. They do that all the time, not just for the benefit of this of the events of this episode. They have been living on this planet for thousands and thousands of years, but they put up this artifice because they just need to show the rest of the universe that there's something there, but it has to be non-threatening enough that they won't bother them.
Okay, I see. So they're just going through these kind of like, hey, this worked for 1,000 years. Let's just keep this one up, even though the Starfleet has been kind of out there, what, 200 years at this point?
I think they said something to that effect.
I don't know. This whole thing just feels full of Swiss cheese holes.
No, it's senseless. I'm telling you right now, this explanation is senseless.
And kind of breaks the red. I mean, there have been some omnipotent, fiction-breaking beings before, but being able to project yourself to Earth and around the entire universe, or galaxy, let's say.
And just shut down all their technology if you feel like it.
Yeah, that's a big one.
So this species, the Organians, does come around again, but not until Star Trek Enterprise.
Oh, wow. Huh. I love when the stuff comes back.
And so the way they are portrayed there is that a couple of Organians come across, I think, the Enterprise, and this is in their era of non-interference. And so, like, I think one of them kind of breaks that and gets involved in something involving whatever the hell the Enterprise is up to then. And they kind of reference, like, okay, well, now the humans know about us, so I guess we should prepare to meet them in about 5,000 years. But then that didn't happen, obviously, because much sooner than that, the Klingons came calling, and then whatever happened, happened. So I don't know.
Mm.
Clearly, they're not that. I mean, they're kind of good at predicting the future because they predicted the Klingon thing, but they also apparently missed the mark on when they would meet up with humans. So I don't know. I don't know what's going on there. I don't know how omnipotent they are. They seem weird. They seem like weird guys.
A little cultist.
Yeah.
Then they kind of have this thing where it's just like, oh, well.
Yep. It would have been nice.
It would have been nice to fight you.
Fascinating. Pure energy. Pure thought. Totally incorporeal. Not life as we know it at all.
But what about this planet? The fields, the buildings, this citadel?
Conventionalizations, I should say. Useless to the Organians. Created so that visitors such as ourselves could have conventional points of reference.
But is all this possible?
We have seen it with our own eyes. I should say the Organians are as far above us on the evolutionary scale as we are above the amoeba.
Well, Commander, I guess that takes care of the war. Obviously, the Organians aren't going to let us fight.
A shame, Captain. It would have been glorious.
You know?
Well, Kor's like, I would have loved to do battle against the Enterprise and their captain. You know, like, that's kind of what he wanted. And Kirk is like, I will say, the denouement, the moral thing at the end, where Kirk is like, I can't believe I was so heated for a war I didn't even want.
You've been most restrained since we left Organia.
I'm embarrassed. I was furious with the Organians for stopping a war I didn't want. We think of ourselves as the most powerful beings in the universe. It's unsettling to discover that we're wrong.
Captain, it took millions of years for the Organians to evolve into what they are. Even the gods did not spring into being overnight. You and I have no reason to be embarrassed. We did, after all, beat the odds.
Oh, no, Mr. Spock. We didn't beat the odds. We didn't have a chance. The Organians raided the game.
Is, like, there's a nugget of good moral in there of, like, rethinking your mentality and understanding that, like, yes, even someone who is conditioned to want peace and not to want war can be brought to that kind of bloodthirsty place in the wrong situation. But it's unfortunately wrapped up in this completely batshit wrapper of everything that's taken place before.
Yeah, pretty uneven episode. I really liked the banter between Kirk and Kor, though.
Yeah.
At least it's got that going for it.
Yeah.
It does.
I think back to what you said, Brad, too. By this point in the airing series, I think there's a thing they say, Kirk says at the end, is like, man, I keep forgetting we're not the most powerful things in the universe. And it's like, dude, how do you keep forgetting that? That is, you have like half the episodes now are revolve around you not being the most powerful thing in the universe and kind of having to come to terms with it.
But, you know, at the same time, like, the way they are portrayed in the show, humans are kind of the protagonists of reality, so I kind of understand where he's coming from, even if, obviously, he's wrong.
Even the gods didn't get it right, or whatever Spock says, right away.
Even the gods didn't emerge overnight or something like that.
Yeah.
Oh, they also say, like, I did appreciate this. This is maybe one of the better parts of the kind of explaining the episode. You know, because we said Kirk and Spock basically take on the entire Klingon occupying force and make it to Kor and basically have them at phaser point. And then at the end, I think Spock is like, you know, we did kind of save the day there. And, you know, Kirk is like, no, man, they fixed the game. Like they cheated. There was
nothing for us to save.
Yeah. I think he says we beat the odds. He's like, no, we didn't. They fixed the game.
It's good that you mentioned that because they also try their hand at another odds joke with Spock in this one when they're calculating their odds of survival in as two men against an entire army of Klingons. I don't think that's a good repeating joke.
Never tell me the odds.
Yeah.
It's not my favorite episode.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, parts of it are kind of weak, but.
I think Colicos as Kor is probably its one real success.
He is definitely the standout. Like, that actor is putting in work for sure.
Yeah.
But otherwise, it feels a little bit more like the earlier episodes in this season.
I think in a season with Khan, in a season without Khan, he would be a great villain. In a season with Khan, it's hard to not compare him.
He's pretty good.
He's pretty good. Also, I did like that Romulan episode. I think it just...
Yes.
There was like a little more fleshed out there. Than this kind of weird occupying force with these omnipotent beings.
Well, I do believe this will be our only Klingon appearance for this season, though they become much more prevalent in season two when we get there. But that is the debut of the Klingons. We have much more Klingon stuff to get to over time.
It doesn't.
But it'll be a while before we get there.
It just doesn't square with what I had heard about the Starfleet and Klingons, because I always thought. The way I heard it was, you know, explaining why the Starfleet was out there was they were looking for Klingons circling Uranus.
And that's going to do it for this week's episode of the Next Liner Watchcast. Thank you, Vinny. Thank you, Brad. Thank you to everyone at home watching along with us. Next week, we're doing Captain America 1990. I'm not going to let this continue. I'm ending this episode right goddamn now. I'm pulling this car over. I'm pulling this podcast over. We are turning around and going home.
Come on, you guys. You never heard that Star Trek joke?
Yes.
Yes, okay,
I didn't need to hear it again. Okay. What are the odds of me hearing that joke again?
7,351.
You guys looking forward to Captain America next week?
I sure am. I love the MCU, so here we go. Buckle up. Give me some modern Captain America.
Oh, it's going to be something. And then at the end of this month, we will be doing, as I said, a triple header of the final three episodes of Star Trek. That will be in 2 weeks. And those final three episodes are The Alternative Factor... which is, I think, is another one that I have never seen. The City on the Edge of Forever.
Would you guys reference this episode? It sounds like a
by Harlan
banger.
Ellison.
Okay.
And Operation Annihilate, which I'm pretty sure is a Let's Kill All the Space Parasites episode.
And that's the season finale?
Yes.
Do you know if it's like a season finale, or is it just going to be like a? I need to know before we get in there. Is it just another last episode?
I'm guessing the way that the executives were determining the airing order, that it's probably just an episode.
Ah, okay.
So I will say, at this point in the season, they knew they were being renewed for season two.
Ooh.
But I'm pretty sure during this era of television, more often than not, season finales were, this is just the last episode. We'll see you in 4 months.
Okay. All right. We're not going to get, like, McCoy shot at the end.
I mean, there's no real long-running plot lines through any of this. This is week-to-week stuff, man.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Okay.
All right. As I said, that's in 2 weeks. Captain America 1990 next week. We're going to wrap this podcast up. Thank you, Vinny. Thank you, Brad.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you to everyone at home listening and watching along with us. We'll see you next time. Round Uranus.
I wanna know what you're feeling. Tell me.